But I find that moving towards discomfort all the time helps me when I get into those life or death situations and how to process it. I think it's those lessons of while enduring hardship and seeing the good in it then trains me or helps me prepare for when those bigger issues happen, like life issues happen, then I feel like I can apply that mentality to even those situations.
Hello and welcome to Choosing Fearless. My name is Maxwell Frost. The goal of the show isn't that we never have fear again, because that's not possible, but rather together we begin to incrementally choose fear less. My guest today is easily one of the most interesting people on the planet. She's traveled to some of the most hidden corners of the world for publications like National Geographic, Outside, BBC, and Men's Journal to photograph places that not many foreigners have ever been. In our conversation, we discuss being seasick for a decade, being told she had 1 to 4 years to live, and being treated like royalty at a stranger's wedding in India. There's a reason Jodi was included in Men's Journal's 25 Most Adventurous Women of the Past 25 Years. I met Jodi 6 years ago at Outdoor Retailer in Salt Lake City. Outdoor Retailer, for those of you that don't know, is the largest gathering of the outdoor industry in the country, a company I randomly ended up working for years later. At the time, I was moving from Denver out to Southern California to focus on surfing and tacos for a bit, and had sold everything that didn't fit on my motorcycle. And on the trip out here to California, I stopped through at Outdoor Retailer, and I met her at a party after the show and have followed her work ever since. Some of the topics we discuss include adversity is always worth it, learning from loss, thinking things into reality, near-death experiences, and the importance of intentionally choosing discomfort in our lives. Jodi, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're probably best known for photography. When did this whole photography thing start for you?
I think it goes back to when I was a kid. When I was going to school, my favorite classes were always art and sports in phys ed class. And I really thrived in both those classes. And I got really into painting when I was in high school and I loved it, but it was I'm a perfectionist. I'm very detail oriented. So all the paintings I do would take forever, which kind of made me frustrated or even a little deterred from even starting a new one. Cause I was like, oh, this is going to be such a slow, painful process. And then when I was in university, I actually got my bachelor in outdoor recreation, which everybody makes fun of me for, cause it's not a real bachelor degree. But I took photography as an elective. And for me, it was like lightning striking. I was like, wow, this is my artistic medium, because I was getting, you know, pretty immediate feedback. I was in the dark room, but you know, you could really mess around and get feedback on your art, like quite, you know, very quickly. And so I loved it. And then on top of that, I was like, oh my God, I can take a camera with me and all my outdoor adventures that I'm doing and like combine my passions. And I remember I was just like so excited. I was like, yes, this just feels so right. I mean, even though, you know, I don't like, you know, in college, you're getting a lot of this societal pressure and parental pressure to like, you know, do something serious that will, you know, pay the bills. But I was just kind of like, you know, I don't know what any of that's going to be. I'm in love with this right now. Mm-hmm. And so that's when it really started for me.
You've taken thousands, if not millions, of photos in your lifetime. Do you have a favorite photo that you've taken over the years? And if so, what is it?
In a lot of ways, it's got to be probably my most obvious answer, which would be my swimming elephant. I think it's my favorite image for what it really represents. Because I was living on a sailboat at the time that I decided to go pursue the story of this elephant. I didn't actually even know anything about this elephant at the time. I was watching a movie on the sailboat, a Hollywood movie called The Fall. And in it, they had this, you know, elephants swimming in this tropical blue water. And I remember just thinking, like, is this a Hollywood set or is this like a real thing? Because I've traveled to a lot of places and I don't know anywhere in the world where there's elephants that swim in tropical blue water. You know, like, where is this true? Anyway, so after watching the movie, I went and Google searched it and saw to see if I could like find any information. And I found out it was that there was actually like they filmed this real elephant living in the Andaman Islands on this tropical island. And, you know, he likes to swim in this blue water. And that's all I knew. And I decided to get off the boat for like a month and go pursue the elephant and just kind of see where it went. I was like, I have to just experience this. Like, if it's possible, I have to. So I ended up finding, getting to the, you know, asking a lot of people, getting to the right island, finding the elephant. And then I ended up documenting him and his caretaker and just learned that it was this fascinating story. And for me, it ended up getting published in the BBC. And it's, you know, my most popular photo series I've ever done. And for me, I think I just fell in love with not only the whole story of Rajan and, you know, seeing this kind of relationship between a human and an elephant. It was just so profound to me experiencing that and being able to photograph it. But for me, it really represented how important it is to really go take chances. You know, it was like my first big break in photography. And I took this huge chance and it paid off, like, and it's still paying off. For me, it's just this constant reminder of, yeah, you know, if something really interests you and you're really passionate about it, you know, you have no idea where it's going to go, but it's always, in my experience, it's always worthwhile. And so when I look at those photographs, it reminds me of that.
That's such a great reminder to take the chance, pursue your passions, and that it often pays off. More people are taking pictures now than ever before on the planet, because everyone has a camera in their pocket and a decent camera at that, as well as all these different platforms to post pictures on regularly. But what separates the average photo from like a National Geographic or BBC quality photo? Like, what's the secret sauce to making an amazing photo?
Good photographs are actually very hard to take. I think the untrained eye sees a lot of good photographs, but I think the more you take photographs and the more you analyze what makes a good photograph or the compositionally. And if you're a Nat Geo photographer, when you take pictures and you submit them to the editor, you can't crop them. You can't do anything to them, which means you have to take the picture as good as you can within that frame. You know, you can't do anything to it. And because of that, you know, taking a good picture is really hard. Like, a really good picture that evokes emotion and has layers and depth and kind of really tells a story, they're very difficult to take. And there is, I can't remember what famous photographer, but he said, you know, you might, as a professional, you might take 10 good photographs in your lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, when photographers, you know, even professionals are known for their photographs, they're going to be known for probably just a couple. For me, it's like the difference is a lot of time refining the craft, trying to get better and better and better. And it really is like persistence and not giving up and just kind of training your eye at being able to see and figure out all that stuff. I'm still learning so much. Like, I still feel I know nothing, because that's how hard it is in my mind to achieve a great photograph. It's just so overwhelmingly difficult in my mind that like, it's a lifelong pursuit. And I just love the process of it. Yeah. And I just think when I get asked that question, it's just, I think for a lot of people, they see amazing photographs everywhere. And there are a lot of good ones, but there's also not a lot of good ones.
Yeah. The overwhelming majority of them. In preparation for this discussion, I listened to your podcast with Chase Jarvis. And in that discussion, you had talked about how you were born in Canada, but then you moved to Saudi, and now I believe you're back in the US. which I think is a fascinatingly unique way of seeing the world, understanding in large part how the Middle East sees the world, as well as how the West sees the world. And here in the US, we don't get both perspectives. So I'm curious, in what way or ways did growing up in Saudi shape your worldview in a positive way that may be unique to the Middle East?
You know, as far back as my memories go, I was living in Saudi. So, you know, the divide of the sexes and, you know, the Muslim culture and everything like that seems so foreign to a Westerner. But to me, because I grew up in it, it was very normal. I think where my exposure to how different it was when I came back to Canada during like at summer holidays, you know, and kind of getting infused with other Canadian kids. And they're just like, oh my God, or even other adults who would make comments about, oh my God, isn't it dangerous living in Saudi Arabia? Isn't it scary? And how do you feel being a female? And, you know, I'd get these questions. I'd be like, wow, I don't know what you're talking about. Cause it's just kind of all I know. All I knew at that time. Now looking back on it, one of the perks that my dad got for working there was we got paid vacations, and my parents had never been anywhere. So every school break and holiday, my parents were like, we're going to go somewhere we've never been before and take advantage of the situation. And I remember my parents were like, we want to make money. Let's go on vacation, because the company would give like a set budget, and then they would try to, you know, get the cheapest airfares and everything, and then like kind of pocket a few grand after the vacation, you know, kind of thing.
Nice.
Yeah. So we did a lot. We did a ton of traveling, and, you know, that really opened my eyes to just how amazing the world was. We didn't just go to Europe. We went all over Africa and Asia, and I just got to explore a lot of different nooks and crannies of the world. And I was just fascinated with it. And I just loved the adventure that I associated with it. I'm pretty sure like just growing up in Saudi was just, even though I might not have known it was exotic, it still felt exotic in some ways, you know? And, you know, I think that has very much put an impression on me as an adult of still wanting to go explore and seek out adventures in the world and have kind of crazy life experiences. Looking back, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine, you know, it played a huge role in who I am today.
Men's Journal has you listed as one of the top 25 most adventurous women of the last 25 years, which is a phenomenal list to be on. I know you've been on a lot of trips and had a lot of different experiences, but do you have a favorite trip or expedition that you've been on that really stands out from the rest?
Well, I mean, living at sea for 10 years,
I could see how that could stand out.
That felt like one long, strange trip. Yeah. And I've been meaning to do a coffee table book about it. And I was going to call it A Long, Strange Trip. you know, I'm just trying to think out of all the places I've been. I mean, a lot of places stand out for different reasons. One place in particular that I really fell in love with was Papua New Guinea and Western Papua. I just fell in love with that whole area. It's just so raw and culturally fascinating, and biodiversity wise, it's unbelievable above and below the ocean. And it just feels like going back in time, just with this rawness to it. Like if you were, you know, to be able to explore be one of the first explorers again, you kind of feel that way when you're in that area. And there's not too many places that I've been to that still leave you feeling that way, you know, that they exist. And so, yeah, I just fell in love with that area. So that area for sure really, really stands out for me.
When it comes to traveling to places like Papua New Guinea and many of the other less traveled places you've been, it takes a certain ability to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And in your TED Talk, What Is Your Why? You mentioned being seasick for 10 years straight, getting a staph infection so bad it made your face inflate like an elephant man, getting E. coli in India. Traveling to the places you go takes flexibility, and a willingness to be able to roll with it, and open to being very uncomfortable at times, which is in complete contrast to life here in the West, where comfort is king. We spend tremendous amounts of time, money, and energy being comfortable and trying to remove any inconvenience from our lives. Yet, to go on the types of trips that you go on, you need to be okay with being inconvenienced, maybe regularly, more often than not, be okay with being sick, be okay with not being able to speak the language or living off rice and beans for weeks at a time, so that you can go to the places you want to go, so you can then bring those stories back. So what I want to know is, how have you been able to develop those muscles over the years?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and one that I think a lot about, because I feel like it is so important to so much of my life, being uncomfortable, and the value of being uncomfortable. And I often think about, like I've come to a place in my life where I actively seek being uncomfortable, because for me, I've learned that that's where all the best rewards in life come from, almost. You know, it's where I grow the most as a person, and I grow the most in having like meaning and purpose in my life. And usually the best things that I can think of come out of it. So instead of me trying to shy away from it, I actively try to pursue it. And then when it's happening, I gravitate towards it. But I obviously didn't start out that way. So I think my brother played a big role in that. He, for some reason, was always really into challenging himself as a person. And in return, I was the younger sister, so he always tried to have me challenge myself. And I remember resisting it a lot when I was younger. And then I think he was just really persistent at annoying me to challenge myself. And I think, you know, then when you start to see progress in challenging yourself, then you're starting to say, oh yeah, you know, there's something to this. There's something there. And then, you know, over that time I kept, and well, my brother also places a lot of importance on life experiences and different life experiences. And I think got really inspired by that. And so I think that combined with my childhood of traveling, anytime I got an experience to do something different or new or travel somewhere, I wanted to take advantage of it. Because I just knew, like, I learn so much every time I take a chance and I have a new experience. So I placed a lot of value on that, and that has just progressed over the years. Yeah, I kind of kept doing it, and kind of in many ways just kind of upped the ante, you know, like I, you know, living at sea for 10 years, I never intended to do that initially. I got offered to go on a boat in the South Pacific, and I had no idea how long I would be out there. I mean, it could have been 2 weeks, it should have been 10 days, really. In terms of like how I felt, and, you know, for my TED talk, the storm we got in. And, but, you know, I knew that I would never have this opportunity again, to sail in the South Pacific. So I knew if I went home and gave up to my comfort zone, to my, you know, wherever I was at the time, I knew I wouldn't like myself for it. I would really regret it. I would regret. Yeah, I would feel like I gave up, and that I didn't want to be that kind of person. I also knew that, like, you can't just quit this and then get another opportunity to do this. You know, I was like, this is it. So why don't you stick it out despite how miserable it is at the moment, and see how it goes? And I also was just so interested in the exploration component of sailing, like getting access to places that you can't otherwise get to. You know, I mean, a boat is amazing for access into just so many new places that just haven't been explored. So that thought excited me way more you know, then the alternative, which was, oh, quitting and going home. And then what? And then what? Like, you know, I go and find a job at McDonald's. I don't know. You know what I mean? So yeah. I was like, no, I want to stick this out, see where it goes. And then at the same time, I was really trying to take my photography seriously. I wanted to say like, no, I wanted to explore and use my camera to document my exploration and just see where that went. I didn't know where it would lead at all, but that was a way better alternative in my mind than giving up. And so I think you do that a number of times and then you realize that, you know, it almost always works out amazingly, way better than your expectation.
Way better than you could have ever dreamed.
Better than you could ever dream because you couldn't even dream it up. The stuff that happens, it's like, it's just so much better than I ever could think. And so that just over and over and over, that keeps happening. And so, you know, I've gotten to a point where I'm just like, yeah, bring it on. When it gets uncomfortable, that's when it gets good.
Yeah. You almost start looking forward to the resistance because, you know, when you push through that's where the magic happens.
Yeah.
And you see that time and time and time again, and you begin to expect it.
Right.
And it's such a fun place to live.
It's such a fun place to live because you don't know when it's going to show up. Like it could show up months later. Like there's so many times where I go do something just because I want to do it and it's uncomfortable or something. And I'm like, well, that could have been a waste of time and money, but I don't think so. Like I don't look at it that way. And then 2 months later, somebody says, oh, I saw you were here. Do you want to go do this? And I was like, there it is. Like, you know, like, yeah. It's so cool. Yeah. And you can make it happen. And I'm convinced that all happens by, you know, putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. I've talked about this in a couple of podcasts because I think it's just such a cool thing to think about. But there's a Jordan Peterson interview, which he's super controversial, but it's interesting just hearing different sides of a lot of different common arguments. But he says in one of his interviews, you have to encounter as much uncertainty as you can voluntarily tolerate. And I think that's true because he says that's where your right brain and your left brain, like order and chaos, like you're riding that line of order and chaos, but you're in this space of flow, basically, of what you're doing and experiencing, but yet you're pushing yourself just a little bit in growing. So it's like, it's really where you find meaning and value and purpose in life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's 100% true. I think that's why I'm in constant search of that uncertainty so that I can try to push that line, you know, and get that meaning and value. It feels so good when you're there and it just feels magical. I've come to realize that it all stems from uncertainty and uncomfort.
I love that quote. You need to encounter as much uncertainty as you can voluntarily tolerate. I feel like that voluntarily part is really important.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's a big difference between voluntarily stepping into those places versus just surviving them.
Right. You don't want to be pushed too much over the line to the point where you're out of your capability, you know, and you're just in this completely horrible, traumatic situation. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, you're trying to ride that line of just the edge of comfort, discomfort, pushing it because you are, you know, that's where you really thrive.
For the first episode of the show, I interviewed my friend Tor, and he talked about being in tribal Afghanistan and walking by a guy with a Kalashnikov and how you could see that as, oh my God, I just survived walking by this guy, rather than curiosity and walking up to the guy and getting to know him. Because Tor has so many stories of talking to those people that result in being invited to all these parties and staying at their home and meeting their family. So it's the difference between, oh my God, I just survived walking by this guy versus voluntarily choosing curiosity and choosing to walk up to the guy and get to know him and learn his story. And both Tor and myself have consistently had amazing experiences doing that, choosing to be a little uncomfortable, just knowing that that might be where the magic happens.
Right. And I agree with that as well. I have a good example of that. I went on a trip like 2 years ago to India with a friend of mine who's a writer, and she had never been to India before. And I remember one day we were in a hotel room and this Indian guy knocked on the door, and I wasn't in the room at the time. She couldn't understand, like, in Indians trying to speak English very well. Like, she just couldn't make it out a lot of what it said. I remember I came back to the room and she was like, "Oh my God, there was this Indian man at the door. I'm like, I don't know what he wants, but oh my God." Like, she was like so rattled and thought that he was going to like break down the door and accost her or rape her or something. And I was like, "Well, what did he say?" And she's like, "I don't really know, but he was saying all this," you know, she got really worked up about it. And then I remember I was like, "Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to say. Like, he's not, you know, he didn't do anything bad. So let's see." Yeah. Anyway, so he knocked on the door again, like 20 minutes later. And I answered the door and I was like, "Hello." And he's like, so he introduces himself. And, you know, I've been to India quite a few times, so I could understand what he was trying to say. But he was basically, it was like, "Celebrate your sister day," which was a really big deal. And he didn't have his sister there, but his wife was there in the room. So he said, "Can you come to my room?" And my friend was like, "Oh my God, do not," and go to the room. And I was like, "No, he needs to do this thing for a ceremony." Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, let's go check it out." And so we go into his room, his wife's in there, his kids are in there. I pretend I'm his sister so he can celebrate this event. Yeah. And they do this whole ceremony and bless and everything. And then we end up at a party and then he gives me money for it. And then it goes on for hours. And then we go back to the hotel room. And my friend was just like, "Wow, that was the coolest experience." And my preconceived notion was like, "Oh my God, go on the defensive. Like, he's trying to harm me," instead of being open. And, you know, and I thought, yeah, that's so much of what we're taught through media and everything in our Western society is that, like, you know, don't talk to strangers and, you know, everything's out to get you. But man, when you just turn that around and open up to the world, like, that's where the magic happens too. Like, my best experiences are because I just go, you know, go with it. And I mean, you got to trust your gut too. I've been in other situations where my gut's like, "Get the hell out of here." And I do, you got to listen to that, but you got to really be more open-minded, because that's where you, like, those are the best experiences anybody will have traveling. And I'm pretty sure that, like, my friend now, she talks about that experience all the time. It's like one of her highlights, you know, and she could have easily missed it just because, you know, she was so initially inclined to just think it was a bad situation.
Yeah. Like you said, you do need to trust your gut in those situations. But man, saying a simple yes in India can go from enjoying tea in someone's house to at one point, my friend David and I, we were invited to a dance party with 40 dudes at a loading dock at an apple farm.
Yeah. I don't know if I got invited to a wedding, but like in my rickshaw through India. Yeah. We got, you know, you go for a chai and you end up at somebody's wedding and then you're like the center of the wedding. Like, you're like a Hollywood celebrity in the middle of a wedding.
Oh, it's such a cool place, man.
Earlier in our conversation, I briefly mentioned your TED Talk. And it's called "What Is Your Why?" If you're listening to this and have not seen it, I strongly suggest you go take a look at that. And there's a line that really stuck out to me that I think relates to this conversation. In your TED Talk, you say that adversity is always worth it. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to, you know, what we were just talking about. It's just that time and again, over and over, anytime I've had that adverse situation, non-ease of use even, you know, it's just things that are more difficult, more challenging, have always paid off countless of times more than by not seeking it. I can't emphasize it enough into self-confidence, self-worth. You get so many good things out of it that I can't say enough good things about it. Mm-hmm. you know, and I just see so many young kids now who are just brought up in this overprotective environments. And I just, it makes me really sad because it's like, I feel you're going to miss out on so much in life and so much self-reward. And again, self-worth, like, you know, especially with young women, I see a lot of them are really not that confident. And I think a big part of it is that we, you know, our Western society, at least we coddle them so much and we protect them at so much. And we, you know, we tell them, oh, you know, you shouldn't do that and you shouldn't do this. And I just think life's hard enough, you know, like why not make it as fulfilling and enjoyable as you can?
Yeah.
And I think adversity brings all the good stuff to your life.
Yeah, I would completely agree. It's been my experience as well. What would you say to someone who's listening to this and realizing that they've made comfort and avoiding adversity at all costs, like their main focus in life, one of their main priorities, and that are listening to you now and realizing that they know deep down that stepping outside of comfort, stepping out and trying new things, stepping out and maybe taking little risks is where the magic really is. What would you say is a good first step towards embracing adversity and stepping outside of their comfort zone?
Well, I mean, I think it can start in any everyday life things, really. I mean, I think if anybody asks you to do something or an opportunity arises that just kind of makes you uncomfortable or you don't really like doing, then maybe just try it. Try to do it and then keep doing it just for a little while to see what comes out of it. I know, like for me, I do this, I'm a horrible runner. I hate running, but I go to this run class twice a week and in it are like, you know, Olympian runners. They're like marathon runners. They're so good. And I hate running, but I do it because of that. You know what I mean? Like I do it for that very reason. I want to get to a point where I do it enough where I, A, don't hate it anymore or don't fear it. Because I know if I put myself doing stuff like that in my day-to-day life, then it makes all those bigger, harder things even easier. I can say, well, look, I can do that and that's really hard. So then I can at least try to do this. I know the comfort zone always sounds the best and it definitely feels the best. But it, in terms of reaping rewards, it's not. So yeah, I mean, I would just try taking those baby steps into doing things in your everyday life that you might not like to do, and then just try to do them and have an open mind about it. Try to look for the good things that you're getting out of it instead of focusing on all the bad things that you're getting out of it. That's the other thing. I think it's, for me, it's a huge mind shift. Whenever things go wrong, I find myself in a negative headspace. I try to catch it and go, whoa, you've got like a negative mind space going. Let's turn this around. What are the good things you're getting out of the situation? Then it's a game changer. It changes everything. How I feel in that moment, it changes my mood, it changes. And then all of a sudden I notice I'm actually gravitating towards it because now I've, instead of seeing it as a bad experience, I'm seeing it now as a positive one. So now I actually want to participate in it more. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool that you can just shift that mindset and it changes the whole experience for you, which makes you really realize your perception of any situation is creating the outcome of that situation for yourself.
Yeah, our thoughts create our reality. I had a mentor years ago that said, you get more of what you focus on. So be intentional on what you're focusing on. And for me, it's easy to spin out and not even realize it that I'm focusing on all the things that aren't working and all the bad stuff that sucks. And I'm just going to get more of that until I go into meditation or something where it pops up on my radar and think, whoa. I'm going to choose to focus on what's good and what could happen because I want to bring more of that into the world. It's almost as if you can think things into existence.
You really can. And I hear a lot of times, you know, if you do this, what if this happens? And I'm like, you can't think that way. you know, if you go down those rabbit holes of what could happen, it's going to create paralysis. Like, you'll never do anything in your life. You know, yeah, you can think up all the negative possibilities, but can you think up all the positive possibilities? No. That's funny, because that's what keeps us in that negative space, right? It's because we can visualize the bad stuff, but we can't visualize the good stuff. We can visualize the plane crashes and the, you know, everything else, but we can't visualize like all the positive outcomes from that experience. So it kind of prevents us from doing them.
And when we focus on the things that could go wrong, like the plane crash you mentioned, it's completely disproportionate to the likelihood of that thing actually happening.
Exactly. I mean, I would think a lot of that stuff is the equivalent of, you know, maybe even less than getting hit by lightning. I mean, statistically, I don't know what it is, but yeah, it's so slim.
I think it's Seneca that said, we suffer more often in our imagination than reality, which is such a great reminder.
Stoicism is so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty much what we've been talking about this whole conversation.
Yeah, they knew it long ago. They were onto it a long time ago. I was telling a story to a friend of mine this morning. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Alaska, and I was I haven't seen my niece and nephew in a little bit. And my brother lives off the grid in Alaska, and he's a bush pilot, and he's created this like amazing compound. He's got like a landing strip, and he flies bush airplanes, and he's got it all set up there anyway. And my nephew's just turned 18, and he, you know, has built his airplane from scratch. He's a pilot. He's a welder. He built his log home from scratch. He can do all this electrical work. Like, he's just, it's so impressive into the environment that he's grown up in. But anyway, I went snow machining with him one day, because he loves snow machining. And this year they had more snow than they've had in like the last 15 years. So when you go snow machining into the backcountry, it's, you jump off the snow machine and you're almost to your neck. It reminded me of being in the ocean. Like, it just really, like, the snow is like the ocean, and your snow machine's your life raft, right? Mm-hmm. But because there's so much snow, you're getting stuck all the time. And I remember he turned to me and said, okay, Jody, this is going to be really hard. We're going to get stuck all the time. But our mission for the day is you just play as hard as you can and get as stuck as bad as you can. And I just looked at him and I was like, oh my God, like, you just turned 18 and you've already figured it out. This is like the meaning of life, and you've already figured it out. It was just so cool that, like, he had already so much confidence, and he's already gone beyond that point where now he knows how much the challenges are so rewarding, because he's learning, he's getting like maximum learning and reward out of it. And I was just like, that is so cool to realize that at such a young age. I just feel like, you know, I've dawned on that in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, but, you know, to know that at such a young age and actually like seek it out and crave it, it just was so cool to see.
It's such a gift to have at such a young age.
It's a gift. I think it's a gift at any age, but yeah, to get it, because most people, I don't think, ever get it.
I know. It took me a lot of years too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and if you're always in this comfortable space, you'll never get there. You know, you'll never get there.
I think an interesting place to end here today would be talking about your recent health issues and how you've been thinking about those and dealing with those, if you're open to share.
Yeah, for sure. Again, it kind of goes back to what we were just talking about. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, traveling, everybody is just kind of enamored with just traveling all the time, or being, you know, kind of like a Nat Geo photographer, or, you know, just doing living that kind of life. And, you know, a huge downside, which nobody sees, is the, you know, illnesses and parasites and all kinds of things that you get from going to all these places. And I think, you know, over the years, I've had a ton of stuff, like I see you mentioned E. coli and typhoid fever and countless parasites and staph infections and all kinds of stuff. And it's a big part of the reality of living this life. It's hard. And then it was interesting, because right before the pandemic, I ended up getting a health scare, which was pretty crazy, actually. I mean, it's kind of a long story, but I'll try to abbreviate it a bit. But I had ovarian cysts, and most women have ovarian cysts. They're just these cysts that grow on your ovary, and they grow, and then they usually burst on their own, and it's quite painful. But you don't really do anything for it, right? They just kind of go away. And I had a couple of those that were like bothering me in my abdomen, and one ruptured, and so I was in a lot of pain, which made me go to the doctor in the first place and realize I had them. And he said, "Oh well, you have a couple other ones, and they'll probably just kind of dissipate on their own over the next couple months." And I think, you know, looking back, sometimes I felt okay and sometimes I didn't. I just kept thinking, oh, it's these stupid ovarian cysts. And I, you know, at one point, I think 4 or 5 months later, I went into the doctor again. He's like, yeah, it's probably just these cysts. And then finally, I got to a point probably like six or seven months after that, where it was like bothering me enough and my stomach was becoming distended. And I was like, no, like something's really wrong here. Either I'm having a complication with these cysts or something. Anyway, I went in and they did an ultrasound on me, and they found 15 pounds worth of ascites, which is this fluid that shows up in your abdomen only when you have like a growth. So I got, you know, I got rushed to do an MRI, and they found a 5-inch tumor in my abdomen. Ooh. And they told me I had, you know, anywhere between 1 to 4 years to live. Yeah. And, you know, just, you know, life just, it gets, I mean, I just thinking back on it, it wasn't really that long ago. It was just like a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. It's a crazy thing to try to wrap your head around, and it's really difficult anyway. And then I got rushed into the operating room, and I remember the surgeon said to me, okay, when we take out the tumor, we're going to do pathology on it in the middle of the operation. We'll know within 1 minute if it's benign or malignant. Mm-hmm. And if it's malignant, I'm going to have to go in and remove a bunch of other things in your, you know, in your abdomen to kind of improve your chances of living as long as you can, you know? So like giving me another couple of years or something like that. I was like, oh, okay, well, that's pretty daunting. Like, you know, coming out of surgery, not knowing, you know, if a whole section of you was removed or just yeah. like a little bit of it or something. And I remember I came out of surgery and he said, we don't know what it was. And I was like, what? Oh. He's like, yeah, we have no idea if it's benign or malignant. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, we have to send it to Harvard for them to do research on it. And he's like, well, we should know in a couple of weeks. And I was like, are you kidding? Like, you might have to open me all back up and go in again if it's malignant, you know? Don't know. He's like, yeah, I don't know, you know? Anyway, so they sewed me up, and, you know, 5 hours later, I ended up having internal bleeding. They had to rush me back in. They had to give me a huge blood transfusion, which really screwed me up for recovery. Because when you do a blood transfusion, then it's like takes a lot longer to recover. Mm-hmm. I remember I got sent home and I was recovering at home. And then I got the phone call like 2 weeks later, and he's like, yeah, it's benign. He said, you know, you grew a 5-inch thyroid on your ovary. And he says, you're one of 8 reported cases in the world of this ever happening.
What?
Yeah. And I was just like, what? And so then he's like, oh, you're good to go.
And you're like, good to go?
Yeah. He says, you're totally fine now. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I just went from 1 to 4 years to live being like, okay. It is so crazy. I mean, I was even just talking to my thyroid doctor last week, and I asked him a question. He's like, honestly, I have no idea. He's just like, I'm learning along with you. He's like, I've never seen this in my whole life, and I'll never see it again. So he's like, I'm learning the same as you. He's like, wow. what's happening with my case, because they've never seen it before. So nobody knows what's going to happen to me. Nobody can answer any questions. It's just like, wow, this is so weird.
Man, what a wild ride. I've had several near-death experiences myself, and it seems like everything changes after those experiences. Things smell different, they feel different, they look different. I begin to worry less about things that don't matter, like what people think of me, what I produce. And it seems as if almost all of my values and priorities shift after those near-death experiences. And I'm curious if it was the same for you after you're told, oh, you're good.
100%. 100%. I lost a boyfriend of mine in a paragliding accident before I went sailing. And that for me, I had never experienced a close death before. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was a profound experience in my life, the grieving. And I'm not religious, but it was the first time where I started to entertain religion or see, like, it was the first time where I could understand why people believed in a heaven, because it was like, yeah, it's comforting to know or to think that the person you loved is going somewhere better and not just, you know, buried in the ground. And so I started like exploring all these things and thoughts and being open to all that stuff that I had never been before. And I remember it changed me so profoundly. I remember I would get up at 3 a.m. and just like go skateboarding or go hike up the mountain and like paraglide off at sunrise. And just like the nature and the details in life was just so much more beautiful and profound. And I remember thinking to myself, if I can just make choices today that make me happy, and if I can do that every day, then I'm living a good life. You know, like that to me, that's a good life. And to me, that was the most important thing. Just trying to, you know, make choices that I wanted to do and be, you know, make me happy. That was overwhelming for me when he went through that death. And yes, it was the hardest thing one of the hardest things for sure I've ever gone through. But I would say it was one of the greatest gifts I've ever, ever received. Because you don't really truly understand that life is short and not to squander it. I mean, yeah, it's so cliche and we hear it all the time, but you never fully understand it until you experience that, like a death or close like encounter for yourself. And I constantly try to remind myself, like, I think it's so easy for us to forget over time. And then when I had this tumor scare, it brought me right back to that time when I was grieving. I was like, oh my God, this is it. I feel the same way. Like, it was just so interesting in that I love it because it puts this profound like feeling in myself that like I want to live my life to the fullest. You know, I really, really don't want to squander it. I want to go out and do these things, you know, because it's so easy for us just to, you know, go back into that comfort zone. You know, I own a house now and it's just, you know, it's so easy for me just to hang out here. I live in a really great place and hang out with my friends. And it's just like easy for me to do that. But I know that I can't, you know, like it's and these events for me are huge gifts because they're just these reminders that I, you know, not to be complacent and not to stay comfortable.
Yeah. It adds some urgency to life.
Yeah. Very, very much.
Well, this really brings us full circle. How we've been talking about if when things become difficult and we choose to engage them and press in rather than run away, that it can turn those difficult or uncomfortable or scary situations into something that will help us learn and help us grow if we choose to press into that situation. Versus, I know several people that have near-death experiences or lose loved ones that go completely inward and get lost in themselves, and as a result, end up living smaller lives because of it.
Yeah. And I think it either, you know, puts a weight around your ankles and brings you down, mm-hmm. or you can shift your perspective on it, and it can be the best thing that ever happened to you.
Absolutely.
So I think it either goes one way or the other for people. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to tell somebody who's grieving like, oh, just shift your perspective and this will be the greatest thing that ever happened.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that doesn't work well.
Yeah, the worst thing you could say. So it's like, how do we actively train ourselves to do that? That's the key, right? But I find that moving towards discomfort all the time helps me when I get into those life or death situations and how to process it. I think it's those lessons of enduring heart while enduring hardship and seeing the looking for like seeing the good in it then trains me or helps me prepare for when those bigger issues happen, like life issues happen, then I feel like I can apply that mentality to even those situations.
It was a little over a year ago, I was on frozen Lake Baikal in Siberia with my friend David, and we spent the month biking the lake from north to south. It was beautiful with mountains dropping right into the frozen lake. So we're living on a frozen lake, which isn't the easiest environment to live for weeks at a time. And when we came back, that's when the pandemic was a thing. It started to be in the news in the US. Because when we left, it was just a thing happening in China. When we got back, it was a thing in the US. And not long after we returned from Siberia was the lockdown. And people are complaining how terrible life was. And we're thinking, this is amazing. We have electricity. We have things to eat other than Snickers bars and vodka. We have running water. We have warm water. We have Amazon to deliver whatever we need, DoorDash to deliver food. We're a week into the pandemic, and people are freaking out about how terrible life is. So I completely agree. You train those muscles in one area of life, and it translates into several other areas of your life as well.
Oh, completely. Completely. I can't emphasize enough for people to get out of their comfort zone how much value that is.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. It's been a lot of fun. Is there any last thought or question or comment you'd like to leave people with before I stop recording?
I know we hear it all the time, but I just can't reiterated enough, like life is so short. If I ever see anybody doing a job or anything that they don't like, it's like, please change it. You know, I mean, it's just so short. It could end at any moment of any day. And just like, you know, how do you want to live your life and try to actively work towards that? I mean, I know that sounds cheesy, but it really is true.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. I really appreciate it. If you like what I'm up to, please leave a review at Apple Podcast and give us a follow on Instagram at Choosing Fearless, because that helps me more than anything else continue to have quality guests on the show. And like always, I'd like to leave you with a little bit of homework, because knowledge isn't power, rather knowledge applied equals power. But before we get into the homework, I'd like to start with a book recommendation, and it's called The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. Many of the topics we discussed today are explained in depth in that book, and I could not recommend the book more. It's easily one of the most influential books I've read in the past 5 years. To give you a little teaser, here's a few of my favorite lines from that book. Choose not to be harmed, and you won't feel harmed. Don't feel harmed, and you haven't been. The next is, the obstacle in the path becomes the path. Never forget, within every obstacle is an opportunity to improve our condition. The last one being, focus on the moment, not the monsters that may or may not be up ahead. During our discussion, Jody mentioned the importance of doing uncomfortable things. One example she gave was running weekly, even though she absolutely hates running. For her, doing uncomfortable things is akin to mental training, where she trains herself to first catch the negative thoughts when they appear so she can then replace them with the good things and the positive possibilities she may get out of that experience, rather than the bad things and what could go wrong, and how that training has given her the confidence and the mental fortitude to live a bold life. If you're anything like me, you're good at focusing on the bad stuff and what could go wrong. But if we could focus on the bad stuff, it means we can also focus on the good stuff. And as Jody has experienced in her life, and I have experienced in my life, you may even begin to gravitate towards things that make you uncomfortable because they're now framed as positive experiences that will help you learn and help you grow. Because as Ryan Holiday's book so poignantly states, the obstacle is the way. Your homework this week, if you so choose, is to intentionally do something that makes you uncomfortable, and then make a point of catching yourself when you begin focusing on your fears or how much it sucks. Then begin listing off all of the good you're getting out of it, no matter how small or big it may be. Because that one simple thought, that one simple idea of reframing our thoughts in uncomfortable or challenging situations has the potential to completely transform our lives. And it's been my experience that the more you do it, the more you train, the more you begin to crave challenging experiences rather than fear them. So that's one small thing you can do this week to incrementally turn down the volume of fear in your life. This podcast was edited and produced by me, Maxwell Frost, with music by David Deaton.